World Health Organization is warning of a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic in Europe early next year. Hours after losing another election lawsuit, U.S. President Donald Trump attacks Joe Biden for making cabinet choices. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel is responsible for everything that happens in Gaza as it continues to blockade it and carry out attacks. Tom Edwards, Nigel Fitt, welcome. The World Health Organization is warning of a third wave of the coronavirus in Europe early next year if governments do not address issues needed to prevent the spread of the disease. WHO's special COVID-19 envoy, David Nabarro, says that European governments must build the necessary infrastructure to prevent a third wave. Nabarro noted that the governments had missed prevention steps during the summer after bringing the first wave under control. He underlined that such a failure caused the ongoing second wave of the disease on the continent. Europe saw a reduced caseload for a brief period, but infections are again wreaking havoc ahead of the winter holiday season. From Brussels, let's bring in our correspondent there. Jerome Hughes is with us now. Good to have you with us, Jerome. Do you see those infrastructure needed to prevent a third wave of the pandemic as WHO is pushing for it?
WHO, Belarus, is particularly concerned in relation to protecting the elderly people in nursing homes. And we do know that I think that in years to come, when the dust settles and we have the vaccine and this thing is under control, probably this time next year, the thing will be under control. But I think then the post-mortem on how it was handled will begin. And I think one of the major failings will be that elderly people in nursing homes, long care homes, were not sufficiently looked after. And there's been claims of, you know, basically complete neglect actually by some countries in terms of protecting these vulnerable people. And so I think things have improved somewhat. The World Health Organization is concerned as well about easing restrictions too soon. And this is a major problem. I mean, we see new restrictions being introduced in various parts of the United States, various parts of here in Europe. I know that Iran is reintroducing more stricter restrictions and so on. But the problem here is that the health authorities say that these restrictions are necessary, and it makes complete sense from a health perspective, but the economic consequences can be enormous. And so, you know, there is this balance, this ongoing balance between trying to keep people safe and also, you know, trying to keep the economies afloat as well. Now, coronaviruses, of course, they transmit better at this time of year, during the winter months, because, you know, there's less humidity and people are indoors congregating. And there's a lot of concern that if you look at the United States, when you have, you know, Thanksgiving and also Christmas, and here in Europe, Christmas, you'd have millions of families coming together this time of year, at the end of December, to gather for the holiday season. And, you know, people gathered indoors, less ventilation, people trying to keep the heat in the home so they don't open the windows. And so this is really a major concern. And health authorities are advising people to try and give up this holiday season effectively, not for families not to gather in large groups, and for, you know, to keep a small bubble of people during the holiday season, and so that we can enjoy many more holiday seasons in the future when we have the vaccine. But if you look at the public opinion, for example, one university here in Belgium did a study of people to ask them, would they adhere to this health advice, and would they restrict their movements and restrict the number of people they would be with during the holiday season? And more than 60% said they wouldn't. So there is apathy amongst the general public. I mean, this is a situation that's been going on since March in terms of big lockdowns and so on and restrictions. And there is now a setting in sort of tiredness. People are tired of the situation, and they see this time of year as the most important time of year for families. Many people do. And so they, and family and friends, and they want to gather together. And so according to that one study, of course, it's just one study, one university, the majority of people actually are not going to adhere to the advice, which is concerning for health officials. And when we look at a third wave, you know, will hospitals be, hospitals have already been put under so much pressure from the second wave. So if we have a large gatherings at the end of December and then we have a third wave in January, will hospitals be able to cope? Will they have sufficient medication right. here in the EU? It's been an issue. Will they have bed capacity and so on? So all these things are very concerning.
Yeah, so a gloomy prospect. And thank you for that. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels. Our concern is growing over the coronavirus pandemic as the deadly virus keeps taking its toll on countries in East Asia. South Korea reported 300 new cases for a fifth straight day on Sunday, bringing infections to more than 30,700. Some 500 people have lost their lives to the virus. The country's plan to tighten social distancing rules for the capital, Seoul, and nearby areas. Japan also saying it may reimpose attendance limits for sports and other large events as new cases in that country climb to nearly 2,600. That's a daily record since the disease broke out. Overall infections in Japan are now passing 130,000 with around 2,000 deaths. U.S. President Donald Trump has expressed anger over Joe Biden's rush to announce his cabinet lineup. Trump says his Democratic rival is moving too quickly in forming a cabinet. The Republican president says that his legal team is still fighting to prove voter fraud in the November 3rd election. Biden, who has been projected the winner by the media, is set to unveil his picks this week. Trump has refused to concede defeat and continues to file suits in states he believes fraudulent votes have been cast. In the latest blow to Trump's camp, a federal court in Pennsylvania has rejected another case brought in by his lawyers. Also in Wisconsin, state officials have accused Trump's observers of obstructing a recount of the votes in the state's largest county. The U.S. presidential election has polarized the nation, but a new poll suggesting it's just the latest problem in an already deeply divided society. The poll reveals widespread feelings of disunity, but also little faith that a country will heal anytime soon. We have a report from Chicago.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public, as the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if you know, that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years. And also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban, rural, coastal, inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us-versus-them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue, and I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Time now for the news review program. Stay with us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying that the regime is to blame for new escalation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum added that Israel is responsible for anything that happens in Gaza because of its continued blockade and attacks on the coastal enclave. Barhoum stressed that the resistance is only acting in self-defense, in a veiled reference to rocket fires from the Strip. The Israeli military conducted air raids on the cities of Gaza and Khan Yunis overnight. Tanks also hit a Hamas outpost in the town of Rafah. The Tel Aviv regime claimed that they were responding to rocket fire from the Strip, though no Palestinian group has claimed responsibility. Israel has conducted similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months. Now let's get some of our guests' opinions on this. So joining me will be Natalie Strecker, activist and campaigner with Jersey Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, joining us out of Jersey, and also Jeff Aramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst, joining us out of London. Let's go to Jersey first. This has been for months, it's not the first time, and Israel has been doing this and targeting different areas in Gaza at different points. Some civilians getting killed, it's not only Hamas positions. I want to ask about the reason behind this, and Israel doesn't seem to want to stop this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there has never really been a true ceasefire, not since the last full-scale assault on the area. Why Israel keeps doing this, that's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I believe if you look at everything else that's kind of happening around Palestine at the moment, I believe it's an attempt on Israel to really force the Palestinians to capitulate in its entirety. And also to, I think part of the issue is probably around trying, because there is a building of solidarity with the Palestinians, obviously, there aren't two sides to this story. I believe part of it is a campaign to try and destroy that by forcing the Palestinians to react in a way that they lose favour perhaps in different groups, etc. Beyond that, it's really difficult to tell because obviously Gaza doesn't really have an army. It's got some rudimentary rockets. It can't really defend itself, but it's been under a legal blockade for brutal blockade for over a decade now. Yeah, it's a very difficult one, to be honest. It's such a difficult thing to be observing, especially because Israel continues its crimes with impunity.
Right. Now over to London. Mr. Ramini, this has been going on for months, and Gaza has been under siege for years. And you know what the situation is like there, many describing it the largest open-air prison. Do you expect an escalation? I mean, given this point in time, Trump administration gave the largest open support to Tel Aviv.
We've been expecting this for the last few days since that rocket was fired towards the southern settlements in occupied Palestine. And the Israelis were making jokes of it, that because there was some thunder in the area and that we should expect more thunder from Hamas. The Israelis don't need a pretext to hit Gaza. As you said, they've been besieging Gaza since 2007. And they have waged war three times. The last was in 2014, with more than 3,500 Palestinians killed. Hamas should do one thing. Either declare themselves either as a Palestinian resistance fighters or politicians. They cannot keep these channels of communications with Israel through Egypt, through Qatar, through whoever it is, and pretend to be a fighting force for the liberation of Palestine. These rockets, so-called, are causing more damage, more harm to Gaza and to the infrastructure in Gaza than it is doing to Israel. Because every time one of these rockets is fired, either by Hamas or Islamic Jihad or whoever is based in Gaza, Israel blames Hamas and tells the international community we have to respond because we are defending ourselves, you understand. The other thing, Hamas has to agree to whatever terms Mr. Abbas in Ramallah offers them to leave out any doubt who is selling Palestine, Hamas or Fatah. Because who pays for this is not Hamas or Fatah, it's the Palestinian people in Gaza under siege, and the Palestinian people in the West Bank under a different kind of siege called the Palestinian Authority. So for us, the Palestinians, is a lose-lose situation.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. We had Natalie Stecker, activist and campaigner from Jersey, Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, and also Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst, who joined us from London. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Iran has denounced the U.S. Secretary of State's recent visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied Palestinian territory. Tehran says the move was in line with Washington's anti-Palestine stance.
The trip to the occupied Palestinian territories by the U.S. regime's Secretary of State is a bitter issue. If it weren't for the treason of the rulers of a handful of Arab countries, the U.S. diplomat would not have been emboldened to blatantly travel there and breach U.N. Security Council resolutions, and would not have disobediently approved of Israel's anti-human rights moves.
Foreign Ministry spokesman says the treason of certain Arab states and the shamelessness of White House rulers are two sides of the same coin. He noted that those who set the stage for the U.S. to act so blatantly should be held accountable. He also urged a few regional countries that have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv to return to regional cooperation. The spokesman also urged the Muslim world to remain committed to the cause of the Palestinians. Thousands of Guatemalans have taken to the streets in their biggest protests against the government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Police clashed with protesters after a group broke into Congress building and torched part of it by throwing projectiles. Demonstrators called for the resignation of Giammattei over legislators' approval of a controversial budget that cut educational and health spending. They're also angry at the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. That's while the country is still reeling from two powerful hurricanes that hit in November, killing 60 people and destroying farms. And that's a wrap for this news broadcast.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The Holy Quran addresses the leaders of the Kuffar and their followers in a different manner.
In one ayah, the Holy Quran describes these people as the Imams of Kufr. Fight you, the Imams of Kufr, for their oaths are nothing to them. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 12. In one part of Surah Al-Qasas, God describes them as leaders inviting to the fire. And we made them leaders inviting to the fire, and on the day of judgment, no help shall they find. Chapter 28, verse 41. They drag the people into hell. In fact, the severity with which the Holy Quran describes the enemies of Islam and of the Kuffar is related to these orientations. All other people from among the Kuffar, those who seek and cherish the truth and who do not show hostility, are the addressees of that beautiful and holy ayah, "It grieves him that you should perish." Today, the enemy of Islam, the main enemy, those leaders inviting to the fire, is arrogance and Zionism. It is they who are confronting and fighting against Islam with all their power. The last display of this confrontation is the one that unfortunately took place in Paris last week. That indecent show that was performed in Paris is really noteworthy and significant.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger among
What kind of government is the French government? What policy does it have? This policy is the same policy that has offered shelter to the most violent and savage terrorists in the world, the terrorists who martyred a president in our country and his prime minister. They martyred the head of the judiciary branch, many members of parliament and executive and judiciary officials. According to the figures that are available, they also martyred about 17,000 ordinary people on the streets and in the bazaars. They're not ordinary terrorists, and they have sought shelter in France and Paris. That is why the French claim to be supporting human rights and freedom. The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam.
To Allah.
August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. Ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. After the Belgian king's speech, Congolese president Joseph Kasavubu took the podium. But the story did not end there. Although the Prime Minister's speech was not on the agenda, Patrice Lumumba took the podium after President Kasavubu. The participants' stunned look at the Prime Minister had only one meaning. Patrice Lumumba was a dead Prime Minister now. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. The crisis broke out when a white European decided to civilize the people of the Congo. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. he had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. In 1884, the U.S. became the first country to recognize Leopold's sovereignty over the Congo. Leopold took advantage of this opportunity and officially claimed Belgium's sovereignty over the Congo. The shadows of Belgium's colonialism continued to affect the people of the Congo 8 years later and even after Leopold's death. The Congo's indigenous people were exploited as slaves in the country's mines, where they extracted their country's natural resources for the Belgians. The indigenous workers' wives and children were taken hostage to be subjected to harassment and even sexual abuse if the indigenous man refused to work, and they were sometimes murdered. At that time, one of the most common punishments for disobedience was to cut off the two hands. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. Heading a delegation, Lumumba went to Brussels and took part in Congolese independence talks. The negotiations resulted in holding the first free elections in the country. The result of the election stunned many, including Belgian colonialists. The MNC party won the election and Patrice Lumumba became the prime minister. Lumumba's government took office on June the 24th, 1960. He invited all people, even white Belgians, to unity to build a Congo. However, his Independence Day speech worried all those who had a vested interest in the Congo. The Prime Minister did not have to deal with the Belgians only because other powers like the UK and the US had gotten involved in the Congo as well. Lumumba's remaining in power as Prime Minister could pose a big challenge to those countries' growing interests. In August, the CIA station in the Congo sent a telegram to Washington that stated, quote, "Embassy and station believe the Congo experiencing classic communist effort to take over government," unquote. The message was addressed to CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had already managed to overthrow popular governments, including the one led by Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz's government in Guatemala. Dulles warned the U.S. government against catastrophic consequences of communists' encroachment in the Congo, which could likely pose a threat to the free world's interests. On August 18, 1960, President Eisenhower told Dulles that the U.S. needed to do everything it could to remove Lumumba from power. Dulles sent a cable to Lawrence Devlin, the CIA's Congo station chief, ordering him to take more aggressive yet clandestine measures to that goal. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. As the first step, Belgium immediately backed Katanga's independence proclamation. The situation was worsening, and Patrice Lumumba needed extra help to deal with Katanga's separatist forces. Lumumba knew well that his Western enemies accused him of supporting the Eastern Bloc. However, he did not ask for the Soviets' help, although they were famous for supporting anti-West reformist movements. He instead sought the U.S. help. But under the pretext of avoiding a conflict with the Soviets, the U.S. ambassador proposed that the Congo should ask for help from the U.N. Therefore, upon a request from Lumumba's government, U.N. Blue Helmets arrived in Leopoldville and were deployed to some regions, including Katanga. But these forces failed to carry out an effective measure to counter Katanga's separatists. To get more help to counter rebel forces as well as Belgium's military interventions, the Prime Minister headed to the White House without an official invitation. Against all his expectations, the U.S. did not welcome him. Certain American newspapers called him the dictator of the forest, and American officials refused to provide any sort of assistance to the Congo's democratically elected Prime Minister to resolve the country's problems. 15 years later, the U.S. Senate launched extensive investigations into interference of the CIA and the U.S. government in the Congo. The probe was led by Senator Frank Church. According to the reports of the Church Committee, the then U.S. president had issued a direct order to the CIA to assassinate Lumumba, and the CIA had launched a plot to eliminate the Congo's prime minister. To achieve this goal, two projects were put on the agenda. One of the projects was proposed by Joseph Schneider, a CIA scientific assistant. According to Schneider's project, a lethal virus indigenous to the Congo had to be administered to Lumumba in any possible way. In the second project, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb injected a lethal poison into toothpaste that was sent for Lumumba in a diplomatic package. But memoirs of the CIA station in the Congo said American spies in the Congo failed to carry out the operation. As the toothpaste passed its expiration date and was in fact useless, the evidence of crime was dumped in the Congo River. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Lumumba's government needed air transport to dispatch its forces to the state of Katanga. The Soviets provided the Congo government with their aircraft to transfer forces. Relative peace was restored to Katanga. However, the Soviets' assistance provided the best excuse for the U.S. to launch more covert propaganda against Lumumba.
At his news conference, President Eisenhower faces squarely the Congo crisis, which he feels is aggravated by the Soviet Union's intervention by sending planes, technicians, and arms.
The United States deplores the unilateral action of the Soviet Union in supplying aircraft and other equipment for military purposes to the Congo, thereby aggravating an already serious situation which finds Africans killing other Africans.
Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. At the same time, CIA agents transferred new eavesdropping devices to control and anticipate Lumumba's next moves and carried them to the Prime Minister's office through their Belgian friends. All the Prime Minister's contacts and communications came under the CIA surveillance. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu. Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. December 1, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauté. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan. She's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much, and it's my great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much, alhamdulillah. So, as I said, we are going to be discussing some principles.
Yeah.
So, children are our future leaders, right? How do we train them on this so that they can be effective members of the society?
Very good question here. And we, in our previous programs, we discussed about justice at length. So, of course, you know, the justice is the main thing to, you know, lay the foundation of at home.
Very
right?
True.
So today's children are the youth of tomorrow. And they will run the affairs of not only the home, but the affairs of the community and the society in the future. Right?
Yeah.
Because in their own ways, they will be contributing to the societies through their profession that they have learned. So their awareness and understanding of the political compulsions of the community or the country will also be of great importance. They will be the keepers of the cultural and economic wealth of the nations, maybe, to look at the large picture. And they will have to strive maintaining and advancing the greatness of their homeland.
Very true.
Wherever they are. And us, if you go and see, our homeland is actually Islam.
Yeah.
Islamic homeland, we can call it. Mm. One homeland where everybody is scattered all around the world, right?
Yes.
We want to form one organization. And that's all which calls out for when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come and will raise the advent of Imam Mahdi. This is one organization which is one body, and this is what we want to strive for.
Yeah. We want a strong you know, community.
Yeah, that's right. So our youths and our children actually will have to face any kind of government, but we'll have to tackle that rightly.
Yeah.
How to deal with that kind of government. Here we are talking about leaders, remember. How to make the children leaders. And that's very important, because in the Quran also we ask for that. And the Holy Prophet of Islam taught us that he used to recite this in the kunut of his namaz every day. And he has also, like, you know, made it recommended for us to do so as well. You know, recite that dua.
Oh,
that Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yuni waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. This is like, you know, make our children, our spouses to be the apple of our eyes, and, you know, like make our children to be the leaders of the community, the leaders of the pious in the community.
Very beautiful dua.
So we have to raise these children to first of all see, you know, how they could face their own governments.
Yes.
You see, because everything is now different here. There's no one government order yet. So the children should therefore be groomed in their early days how to serve their own community.
Yes.
I can't say country, because every country has the different kinds of, you know, organizations that are not Islamic also. So if we are in Iran, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, you know, with the grace of Allah, we have this Islamic system. But what of other countries? So what I can say is, therefore, they should be groomed from early to be of service to their community